Hello, welcome to Universal Soul Love. This is Detective David Love.
And this is Dr. Lana Love.
Welcome to our show. Today we're very excited to have our special guest, Dr. Rick Strassman, on the show. Rick is the author of Molecule.
And he's a medical doctor specializing in psychiatry who has done a lot of research on consciousness and psychedelic hallucinogenic substances and the effect on the mind, together with melatonin research and research in areas of religious experience and disembodied consciousness and many, many other areas which are absolutely fascinating.
And one of our favorite topics to discuss on this show, McGonagall on the show, McMonagall, excuse me, and we had a fantastic show, and I think this is a great follow-up, and we thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Strassman. This is fantastic.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I'm happy to be here.
It's quite amazing to have another psychiatrist on the show.
Well, you know what they say about how many psychiatrists it takes to change a light bulb?
No, I actually don't. How many?
No, this one I haven't heard.
Only one, but the light bulb really has to want to change.
Okay.
That's a good one.
Yep, that's very appropriate for this show. I wonder how many mystics it would take to change a light bulb. Somebody's got to come up with the answer to that one of these days.
Well, the question is, does the light bulb actually exist?
Oh, there you go. And maybe it's an illusion. But what is an illusion? Okay, that's what we're here to discuss.
So, Dr. Strassman, Rick, can you tell us a little bit about how you got from psychiatry into studying consciousness and psychedelic drugs and religious states?
Well, it actually was, you know, the other way around. I mean, I became a psychiatrist because of my interest in doing psychedelic drug research. It was an idea that came to me when I was an undergraduate and was really struck by the similarities between descriptions of the psychedelic drug state and those resulting from certain forms of meditation, Buddhist meditation. And I began thinking that there must be some common underlying biological denominator that was being activated in both states to the extent that they resembled each other. In other words, it, you know, seemed like there might be some brain activity that was being turned on as a result of a psychedelic drug and as a result of the practice of certain meditation techniques. So I became a psychiatrist in order to look into those connections and start investigating the biological bases of spiritual experience.
Wow, that's really interesting. Lana actually is very much follows the Buddhist tradition, whereas I follow a mystical path. But we're both very interested in esoteric knowledge and just the meaning of life and the nature of reality, which is what we talk about quite a bit. But I'm very much interested in Buddhism as well, and it's just interesting that you actually started out with a strong interest in consciousness, and that's what brought you right into the field of mind medicine, actually, which is the name of Lana's business that we just trademarked, mind medicine.
I think we were talking about consciousness and how Rick started off wanting to explore consciousness.
Right, okay, I'm just going to start right from here then. That's really interesting that you started out with an interest in consciousness, Rick, and you went right into psychiatry from there, looking at the biological aspects and the science of the mind, because Ratlana actually also has an interest in the Buddhist tradition, whereas I'm into mysticism and follow the mystical path, but we're all interested in the meaning of life and the nature of reality and the spirituality of just the mind, I guess. It's so.
But for me, also, I've always been fascinated by consciousness and the brain, which I, you know, consider to be the most important organ. I guess as a doctor in my early days, I was more biologically based and thought that the mind and the spirit was very much in the brain. Now, of course, I think that possibly
the opposite is true. Possibly our consciousness is out there in the ether, and our brain is like a transmitter that, you know, enables us to, I guess, transmit our thoughts and work our body. There's lots of different theories about this. We'd be interested to know what you think about that, Rick.
Well, I mean, I kind of came at it from the biological point of view, or the I suppose both the biological and the psychological point of view. My training as a psychiatrist was sort of a combination of psychoanalytic Freudian psychology and psychopharmacology. So those were the two ways in which I understood how people kind of experienced the world and interacted with it. From the spiritual point of view, I began studying and practicing Buddhism in my early 20s, in particular Zen Buddhism. So that was kind of the spiritual platform that I brought to my research. If you look at Zen, in a way it's like a spiritual version of, you know, Freudian psychology and psychopharmacology. It looks at the mind as kind of the result of the interplay between, the brain and one's experience, upbringing. I guess it includes, past lives as well. But in a lot of ways, the three of those models were pretty consistent with each other, were the ones that I brought to bear when I was trying to understand what my volunteers were telling me about their DMT experiences in my research.
That's just amazing. This consciousness just goes in so many directions. You've mentioned so many things that just bring up things for me, past lives and mindfulness. I took a mindfulness class at University of Massachusetts under John Cabot Zinn, and it was one of probably the best classes I've ever taken in terms of my personal development and spirituality. I'm also a past life regressionist, and so I've had classic out-of-body experiences, and I've had many different types of experiences, and it's just such a broad spectrum
It's a huge area, but I guess it's an area that is at the fringe of, I guess, the sciences. And as a psychiatrist myself, it's I sort of sit between two worlds of science and perhaps consciousness and mysticism, and the two don't necessarily meet. For example, past lives are not something that, we sort of acknowledge in psychiatry, and yet I have met so many people that have, felt and remembered past lives that you can't discount it. At the same time, ghosts and perceptions of other worldly entities. In my psychiatric practice, there have at times been patients whose depression and psychosis seems to be accompanied by the experience of other entities. And for me as a psychiatrist, it's very hard to know what to do, because it's dismissed as being, rubbish by science, and yet the evidence is to the contrary.
I'm not sure about evidence. I worked in the court system, and I worked with lawyers for more than 20 years, and evidence and proof, I don't know. We had this conversation with Joseph McMonagle last week, and he's a scientist as well. And I've seen these entities in classic out-of-body experiences, as I've said so many times, and I don't know what to make of these things or what they are or what their reality is. And I'm an investigator. These things are not acceptable. Past lives are not acceptable. It destroys your credibility, and lawyers use it as a tool, oftentimes in court cases. So it is on the fringes, and what do you make of all? I don't.
Rick, what about you, with your own clinical experience? Did you come across these, difficulties with, patients that may have caused you to confront what science teaches and what science doesn't deal with?
I mean, when you're dealing with psychedelic drug states, especially the more extreme out there ones, it does challenge the, materialistic paradigm out there that it's all a function of brain activity. You know, with respect to scientific evidence for past lives, you know, there just isn't that much. You know, probably the most rigorous scientific work was done by a psychiatrist in Virginia named Ian Stevenson, and he published a major book maybe within the last 10 years reviewing all of his investigations of cases where people claimed they were in contact with their past lives. And, you know, he interviewed thousands of people, and I think he probably just narrowed it down to maybe a handful where the evidence was strong enough for him to believe that those things actually were the case in those in a small number of people. The rest of the time he concluded that it was just an overactive imagination on the part of the person, you know, claiming those kinds of experiences. But with my DMT work, I didn't necessarily hear stories of past life experiences, but I did hear a lot about, contact with beings that seemed to be existing in a freestanding, externally objective, alternate level of reality. They were quite convinced that it wasn't a hallucination or a dream, and that it couldn't possibly be something generated in their minds or brains, but it was actually the perception of, you know, something that was external to themselves. That was, that wasn't like a projection or an imaginary, scenario. You know, so that then, got me starting to look at how it could be the case that DMT provides access to externally real but usually invisible levels of reality.
That's interesting. These entities, like I said, in my out-of-body experiences, I'd seen these entities. And more than 10 years ago, I brought this up with a psychiatrist, a resident. And I described it to him as best I could objectively. And he said, I don't know what to make of that. And he brought it to his supervisor, an experienced psychiatrist. And he came back to me and said, don't worry about it. He said, these are called hypnagogic images. And it's very common to see monsters like of this sort in the when you're just waking up or just falling asleep. And that's really all he had to say about it. And I went on with my life, not knowing what a hypnagogic image is or what the reality of these things were that I saw, that I perceived, and it didn't really explain anything to me. I have no evidence. I mean, as a legal professional or as a legal investigator, I don't have any evidence for scientific evidence for past lives, or I could have a lot. I have a lot that I could say about past lives, and I think Lana could too, in regards to me. But again, could never meet any kind of standard of proof to validate much of it or any of it or any of these out-of-body experiences, really, according to scientific standards. So, but that doesn't disprove it either. It really doesn't. I don't think you can prove or disprove these sort of things, can you?
Well, you could. You know, for example, if you had an out-of-body experience and you were able to, you know, see things that your body, your physical body had no possible way of seeing, that would be evidence. You'd have to come up with a mechanistic explanation but that still wouldn't, you know, militate against the evidence being, you know, being true or real. You know, like if you were able to, you know, see something going on a block away or 100 miles away that your, you know, disembodied consciousness observed, you know, that would be hard to argue with. You know, but, you know, the psychiatrist, you know, calling what you experience hypnagogic, you know, hallucinations, yeah, you know, that's, you know, just a term, you know, that's just an expression. It doesn't really, you know, say it's real or not real. I suppose by calling them hallucinations, they're implied to be unreal, but I think that's just an easier thing to say than to, you know, think about it with any, you know, seriousness. You know, but that, you know, kind of brings to the fore the whole, you know, model of looking at the biology or the science of spiritual experience. You know, the reigning paradigm nowadays is what is called neurotheology, which, you know, posits, you know, that the brain experiences a reflex as in response to certain stimuli, like drugs or meditation or sleep deprivation, which, it, you know, which, you know, generates, you know, subjective experiences, which are then later called spiritual in nature. You know, so that, you know, is kind of the model, if what I call the, you know, the bottom-up, you know, model, where the brain, you know, generates the impression of contact with spiritual realities, as opposed, you know, to the brain, you know, perceiving, you know, from the top down spiritual realities, which are external to it.
Well, in your contact with subjects in your research, Rick, you said that your subjects, despite there being a clear trigger with DMT, that they reported these experiences as real. And it sounds like that you acknowledge that. Did you in your research? Is your formulation of this that DMT triggers an opening of the brain to a wider reality?
Well, in the beginning, I was skeptical of that model. You know, all three of the models that I had brought to bear in my studies, these, you know, the psychoanalytics, the brain biology, and even the Zen Buddhist model, all treated the experiences of my volunteers as basically unreal. Either they were a brain reflex, they were, you know, the visualization of unconscious drives or conflicts, or else, you know, they were just, you know, makyo. They were just, you know, hallucinations on the way towards the, you know, formless, enlightened state of emptiness. You know, so all three basically proposed that what people were encountering was unreal. And even though I kept that to myself, I think my skepticism was perceptible, you know, to the volunteers. And as a result, they kind of began to close off, you know, sharing with me some of the more outrageous, outlandish, incomprehensible aspects of their experiences. And when, you know, that started to manifest itself, I decided to perform a, you know, thought experiment. And, you know, I decided to, you know, take at face value what people were, you know, telling me. And I would then go back to the drawing board after I finished the work and come up with, you know, how it could be that what people were perceiving was actually real. You know, so, you know, once I started to accept, at least at face, you know, value that what people were, you know, perceiving was truly an external level of reality and wasn't being generated by their minds, you know, you know, then that reestablished the open channels of communication between us, and people felt more comfortable disclosing, you know, the more unusual aspects of their trips.
Interesting. I guess it often comes down to a question of what is the nature of reality. And I guess I'm very much an open-minded skeptic because I've gotten to the point in my life where I've had so many experiences and I've heard so many things that I just have a a belief of non-belief, in a sense that I think that we really can't know what reality is outside of our minds. I'm not even sure that we can know what the reality is within our minds sometimes. How do you test what's real or whether something exists on another level of reality?
For that matter, how can you tell the difference between outer reality and inner reality when it might be one and the same if you take a non-dualistic model?
Right.
Well, I think there are certain criteria that most people use to determine if, you know, something is real. There's temporal continuity. There's a certain, cause and effect, consistency, which is taking place. There's a certain feeling of, solidity, to the experience. There's the maintenance of a observing self, and I think ultimately it boils down to that it feels real. There's a certain feeling which is strongly associated with the perception of what we call reality. So there are criteria people use.
Sorry, I was just going to say if one person says something's real, like a child says, meet my invisible friend, my purple dinosaur, and it's real to that child, but it's real to no one else. So is it real or is it not real, I guess? If it's real for one person and it's not real for everyone else, does that mean it's not real or has no reality?
I think people experience things as real, which which other people don't. Like in the case of an imaginary child, that's real. In the case of our dreams, we really dream. We really have a dream, but it's a purely personal affair.
And I guess that just brings up, what is a dream? Do we actually know what a dream is? What is the reality of a dream? Does it have a reality all its own? And we just sort of call it a dream. And it sort of has just something that happens within the mind that's of no real value or consequence. We're sort of digging deep into this, but
there are plenty of theories about dreams, spiritual ones, biological ones, psychological ones. There's that dream tribe in Malaysia or someplace, the Senoi. S-E-N-O-I, there's Australian Dreamtime that the Aborigines pay a lot of attention to and, vouch for as being as real or more real than everyday reality. There's biological models that it's just kind of the brain throwing off things or, using the cerebral spinal fluid to flush out, the interstices of the glia. Psychological models. So I'm not sure if one could objectively determine the reality of the dream state. I think, it kind of returns to, or it, kind of points to the notion of, subjective reality versus objective reality. I think if you can, if you can demonstrate the features of subjective states, those can be determined or can be, called as real as anything else. For example, nobody's ever objectively photographed somebody else's dreams to be able to say, my dream is like your dream. We both dream. But still, there's enough consistency within subjective reports of the dream state that everybody agrees there is a dream state and this is what dreams are like.
Yes, I was interested to hear some of the perhaps more outlandish experiences that some of your subjects had, and just interested to know whether that sort of coincided with any sort of mythological or Freudian states, you know, whether there were demonic or angelic realms that your subjects experienced?
Well, let's see. I guess the most exotic, the most, you know, novel experiences were the encounters with the beings that at least, you know, half of the volunteers described. The beings could take any number of, you know, forms or shapes, plants, mammals, insects, furniture, machine-like things, machine androids, hybrids, humans, humanoids. One of them looked like Tinkerbell, you know, the little, you know, fairy type elf thing in Peter Pan.
I thought she was really.
Yeah, you know, so, and the, characteristics of the beings were that they were, sentient. They felt and, you know, knew things. They often were very intelligent, usually quite powerful. The volunteer was usually overwhelmed at the power of the beings. You know, sometimes it was, you know, vice versa. One volunteer felt that she had to be, you know, careful not to ask too many questions or ask them in too intense a manner, or the intelligence would withdraw. But, you know, generally it was the other way around. Sometimes the beings were doing things to the volunteers. They would be, you know, healing or threatening or harming, loving, you know, teaching. You know, the most, common interaction was communicating, and that took place at a number of levels, but most commonly verbally, and that was usually telepathically, although sometimes through the media or the medium of the spoken voice. One volunteer in particular was being chaperoned around a, you know, hive-like, you know, city, which an insect-like being, like a bee, maybe 3 to 4 feet high, was pointing and showing him around and explained to him that that's where our future lie, in that kind of a dwelling. So there were some predictions. You know, there was outer space travel, travel to different parts of the Earth. Wasn't all, you know, love and light. Some of the volunteers were threatened or frightened. One person actually was anally raped by crocodiles during a big DMT experience. One individual was, you know, kind of trapped by a jack-in-the-box kind of a creature, made him feel quite claustrophobic and paranoid. But, you know, by and large, the experiences were ecstatic, blissful, quite positive, quite transformative.
So I'm wondering whether those that had traumatic experiences under DMT, whether that correlated with their own any traumas in their lives, in their human lives.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to say. I don't think, you know, necessarily, because, you know, there were some people in the study with, some history of trauma. But if they had worked it through, like in therapy or in therapeutic relationships or in their spiritual practice, I don't think that necessarily translated into a traumatic, DMT, session. The one guy that had the anal rape by the crocodiles wasn't that experienced with, you know, psychedelics, and wasn't that comfortable with his, you know, shadow side, I guess, if one were to, you know, generalize regarding his, kind of clinical presentation. You know, he had, you know, mostly taken MDMA and was into love and light and was kind of a, you know, tie-dye kind of a guy. I think the sheer power of the DMT experience, and it's, you know, foreignness was just a little too much for him. The other person who had the jack-in-the-box experience didn't seem like a traumatized guy in any which way. You know, he had been depressed in the past, but a couple of our volunteers had been depressed in the past and went through the study without any major problems. You know, one of the volunteers had been traumatized as a teenage girl and was able to work through some of that trauma during her DMT session. So I think it was more whether people were open to all manner of psychological or, you know, subjective experiences. You know, if they had a certain, you know, fluidity, ability to let go, to accept whatever came their way, I think was the more, you know, salient characteristic, which, you know, held people in good stead. The ones, you know, that were kind of holding on tight or only had a, you know, narrow view of what the psychedelic experience ought to be like, were the ones who got into more trouble.
This is really interesting, I guess, because I guess the question I was going to ask you that you already answered is that I'm wondering if when people take DMT, if they're bringing their past, their early experiences and their emotions into the DMT experience, and if it's sort of playing out in that environment, whatever that DMT environment is.
Knowing that the DMT is called the spirit molecule, I had also wondered and had imagined that under DMT, people would be very much experiencing their inner stuff and processing their inner stuff more and creating more meaning from their lives. Whereas from what you've described, it sounds like more people had encounters with other beings rather than deep encounters with their own self.
Inner self, working out inner emotional issues or something. Is it? Are you thinking of DMT as a therapeutic tool for working out inner controversies? Is that what?
Well, I guess I had thought the DMT would and allow one's consciousness to evolve more.
To expand.
Right. So we're interested in what you think about that, Rick.
The workings of all of those things, the self and the DMT experience.
Well, yeah, I think it depends on what the person brings to their experience. You know, the three pillars of any, you know, psychedelic state is the drug and the set and the setting. And the set is the, you know, psychological and, you know, physical, spiritual state of the person who's ingesting whatever substance they are. You know, so that kind of returns or brings us, you know, back to the notion of, you know, what is the reality basis of people's experiences. You know, you can... Well, there's all manner of, you know, DMT experiences. You know, some can be obviously psychological, purely psychological. Like, for example, one of our volunteers had been, you know, forced to jump into a freezing river as a child to prove his manhood. And, you know, he worked through that, you know, trauma in the DMT sessions of the, you know, feeling of being, you know, helpless in the face of an overwhelming physical and, you know, psychic, you know, blast, as it were. You know, so that was a, you know, purely psychological process on his part. On the other hand, you know, some people, you know, saw visions of the future. They did interstellar travel. Which didn't really seem to have much going on with respect to personal psychology being worked out or displayed, you know, during the session. So I think when you want to, you know, get to the essence of what's being revealed or what can be revealed in the DMT experience, you have to be as clean a slate as you can be. You know, you have to really use a lot of Windex to get your windows clean. You know, because if you know, the window's not clean, it's either muddled or you're just, you know, seeing a reflection of yourself, like a mirror almost. You know, but if you're really polished, if you've really, you know, if you've really done your psychological homework, spiritual homework, you're able to, you know, kind of, you know, drop all of the, you know, personal, you know, baggage and just, you know, forge ahead into whatever the drug can show you.
So it sounds a lot like Luke Skywalker with Yoda going into the Dagobah swamp, and sort of he says, what's in there? And he says, only what you bring with you. And he sort of ends up seeing Darth Vader with his lightsaber, and he ends up sort of fighting himself and seeing himself in Darth Vader. It was very much sort of a reflective experience.
Right. It's like that.
I guess that's one way of looking at it, I guess, or one type of experience you could have. But
That's interesting what you just said, Rick, because I wanted to ask you what you would think of the interview that we had last week, McMonagle, and also Nancy McMonagle, who we've had in the past, who are with the Monroe Institute, which was, you know, originally, I think, started by Robert Monroe, who wrote all those books, Journeys Out of the Body and Far Journeys and The Ultimate Journey, and how those are the out-of-body experiences and astral experiences are similar or different to the DMT experience and what type of reality they might have.
Yeah, you know, I've heard of the Monroe Institute and their work, but I'm just not that familiar with what they write about or talk about. Are there, you know, similarities between what they describe and what occurs in a DMT session?
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking, because since I've had some out-of-body experiences, and I'm wondering how that might compare to a DMT experience and what and the types of entities that I've seen and what people using plant teachers might have seen, if there's any that's comparable in any way.
Yeah, I just can't really comment because I've not, you know, read any of their work. You know, but along those lines, you know, speaking of, you know, a comparison with other non-drug states, you know, the encounter with beings was really, you know, a striking and unexpected aspect of our work. So I, you know, turned to the alien abduction literature, especially John Mack's work and Whitley Strieber's work. And, you know, there's a really, you know, there's a lot of overlap between the alien abduction experience and the DMT state, especially if you, you know, can, especially if you, you know, conceptualize a spectrum of contact experiences with, you know, physical to physical, you know, contact being at one end of the spectrum and, you know, purely consciousness to consciousness contact being at the other, you know, pole of the spectrum. You know, because, you know, clearly people didn't, you know, leave their room or, you know, come back with implants or stigmata, those kinds of things. But, you know, the phenomenology of what they perceived is pretty similar. The, you know, feeling of inner tension and vibration and the sound that heralds the beginning of both, you know, syndromes is quite similar. You know, the feeling of more real than real is quite, you know, similar in both states. And I met John Mack, and, you know, he, you know, wrote a blurb for the first DMT book and was quite struck by how, you know, similar the two, you know, sets of experiences were, and started to, you know, think about and, you know, discuss the possibility that, you know, DMT or, you know, naturally occurring DMT, you know, naturally, you know, produced in the human body, might play a role in the consciousness to consciousness, you know, variety of the alien abduction or the alien encounter, you know, phenomena.
Right. And when you talk about the naturally occurring DMT, is that, I know you've done quite a lot of work with the pineal gland, and I think the pineal gland is best known for production of melatonin, but can you just tell us a bit, is the pineal gland does also produce DMT, is that right?
Well, it's been known for, I guess, 60 years almost that the lungs make DMT in the mammal, including the human lung. So that's been known for a long time. I began to speculate in the early 90s that the pineal also made DMT. And I marshaled a lot of, circumstantial evidence, that the pineal was capable of making DMT. That would have been a really, kind of frosting on the cake, finding because of the importance of the pineal, or at least the area of the head corresponding to the pineal in a number of esoteric, physiological, systems like Kabbalah and the, Hindu chakra, physiology. But it wasn't until just 2013, actually, DMT was discovered in the pineal of the living rodent. It hasn't been established in the living human pineal yet, but it would seem to me that that would most likely be the case if it was determined to exist in the pineal of the living rodent.
And Rick, the pineal gland, is really what's meant by the third eye, isn't it? It's symbolic of the chakra in the third eye chakra of insight.
It's a bit muddled. The third eye and the chakra system is it's located on the forehead between and above the lateral eyes, but that's more the location of the pituitary than the pineal. It's the crown chakra, which is on top of the head, which corresponds to the location of the pineal, and also corresponds to the location of the third eye in lower animals, like amphibians and, some lizards, where the pineal gland is actually a light, sensing organ with a retina and a cornea and a lens, those kinds of things. So the crown, chakra is, more what is, the location of the real third eye and, the location of the pineal, although in, Hindu art or Buddhist art, it's located on the forehead.
Really interesting.
Yeah, and I just want to go back to remember we had a conversation with Matthew Hart a few weeks ago where we were talking about psychiatric patients, and Lana is a practicing medical doctor who works with people who have schizophrenia and all sorts of psychotic disorders. And I've also worked as a case manager in vocational rehabilitation with people who have these issues.
Well, we're interested in, psychosis and delusions, when one person's reality is very different to everyone else's reality. And we're wondering to what extent you think DMT may have a role in that.
Yeah, DMT was investigated quite, seriously in the 50s and the 60s as playing a role in naturally occurring psychoses. Either it was being overproduced in people with psychosis, or people with psychosis were abnormally sensitive to its effects, or else it wasn't being metabolized properly. Those kinds of things. People were, looking at blockading the effects of, DMT in order to, theoretically blockade its being too, being overactive in psychosis. You know, they were even developing some antibodies to DMT, to use as an antipsychotic because of their belief that maybe there were abnormal DMT dynamics in psychosis. That was a promising line of research, one of the many that was, forced to end with the placement of all of these, drugs into Schedule One, and also the anathema or the stigma that became associated with clinical psychedelic, drug research. And, that ought to be focus in the new studies, which have been allowed to start taking place again the last 10, 15 years. It's conceivable that overproduction or overactivity of the DMT system in, psychosis is taking place. Whether or not that provides access to externally real levels of reality which are impinging on the person, or else just abnormal, brain activity, kind of returns to the issue of what's real and what's imagined. One of the results of my, DMT work, kind of spilled over into my working with, psychotic patients, because when they would describe their symptoms to me, I wouldn't as quickly dismiss them as just being brain, generated. I would more start thinking of them as their brains were more, sensitive to external levels of reality. And when, people would object to taking antipsychotic, drugs because of saying, well, these things aren't just in my mind, I'm really perceiving them, I could then, say to them, well, the barrier between, the worlds in your case is just a little too thin, and these medications can strengthen, that barrier. Mm-hmm. So in some cases that made people more amenable to being prescribed these rather unpleasant medications.
There's a theory that with psychosis, people can't filter out all the stimuli from the universe that we can, and they just become completely overwhelmed. But interesting enough, they say there's a really interesting saying that says that the sea that the psychotic drowns in is the same sea that the mystic quite comfortably floats in. So in other words, the mystics can be open to other universes but can somehow straddle that and comfortably. So
and we had this conversation with Matthew, and I can actually understand. I mean, I've seen people, and it's not a question of whether what a schizophrenic or a psychotic person sees is real or unreal. It's that it's overwhelming for them, and it's so disturbing for them that it affects the quality of their life. And so taking medications like Zyprexa or Risperdal or whatnot, I've heard them say that it's very helpful to them to block those disturbing images out. And I know when I've had, in my early days, when I had out-of-body experiences, those things, those entities were very disturbing, and it was almost terrifying. But over time, I learned to just, I sort of rose above all of that and learned to understand, have a better understanding of what this might all be, so that it no longer affects me actually that way.
Yeah, generally people with psychosis or schizophrenia, I guess specifically, it isn't that they're just experiencing these unusual perceptions. Oftentimes they've got other problems, neurological ones, psychological ones, their health, their genetics. It returns in, some ways to the notion of, set and setting. Are these experiences, taking place in a relatively healthy person, or are they taking place in a relatively unhealthy person?
Yeah, fair enough. Very multifactorial.
Yes, indeed. We have to finish off soon, but I'm just wondering whether your work has taken you into any new areas of research.
Right, I wanted to ask you that. What you're doing now?
Yeah. Well, I finished my studies actually a long time ago. I gave my last dose of anything in September '95, so it's almost 21 years now that I've been, you know, doing hands-on research. You know, I still, you know, consult with other research groups around the country and around the world. And I'm actually working on a paper right now with a Brit who lives in Japan who's got a model for giving a continuous infusion of DMT, which would allow prolonged, you know, contact with that world and, you know, hopefully start to provide, you know, better access, you know, to the beings and our ability to interact with them. You know, so I still have my, you know, finger in the pot, as it were. Yeah, but after I finished my studies in 95, I went back to the drawing board and started, you know, looking, you know, for models that might, you know, justify understanding the DMT state as a real phenomena as opposed to just a brain, you know, generated hallucination. And, you know, by the by, I began to read the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament and was really impressed with the descriptions in it of the prophetic state of consciousness experienced by any number of, you know, figures in the text. I compared the phenomenology of the two states, the DMT state and the prophetic state, and you wrote a book that came out about a year and a half ago called it is called you know, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, in which I, you know, compare the states, you know, point out the similarities, point out the differences, and you know, provide some you know, mechanistic explanations, you know, for those you know, similarities and, you know, for those differences. You know, mostly, you know, I do stay current in the, you know, psychedelic research field, but that's more to just be able to converse with, you know, people doing, you know, work in the area. You know, my true love, or, you know, what I'm most, you know, drawn to still is, you know, the Old Testament text and the commentaries, what the information is that's being, you know, transmitted through that text. You know, the message of the prophetic experience, you know, because I think it provides a model for extracting useful information, you know, from the psychedelic, you know, drug state as well. You know, most of the ways people have been, you know, looking at the spiritual properties of the psychedelic, you know, drug state is either, you know, through the lenses of the Eastern religious, you know, disciplines, especially Buddhism, or else, you know, New Age approaches or, you know, shamanic approaches. But I think actually the most useful model is one that's, you know, sitting just under our noses, which is the, you know, biblical tradition of, you know, the one God and the golden rule and those kinds of ideas. You know, so yeah. I'm, you know, kind of, I guess, involved in a stealth operation to get, you know, the prophetic message, you know, kind of instilled into the minds of those who are looking for a spiritual, you know, benefit from taking psychedelic drugs.
So are you talking about revelations and prophecies? I mean, we certainly, in what's going on in the world, the shift, I mean, we certainly, that's a topic of regular discussion on universal soul love, but I've read the Bible from beginning to end, and I do like the biblical teachings, and there's some great lessons there. So, not sure which messages you're specifically talking about, but I can relate to what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, my definition of, you know, prophecy is, you know, that it's a spiritual experience, as opposed to, you know, necessarily being foretelling or predicting. You know, there is, you know, foretelling and, you know, predicting that occurs in, you know, the ministry of the, you know, canonical prophets like Ezekiel and Jeremiah. But I, you know, broadened the definition to include any kind of spiritual experience, and you know, which is, you know, which is had by any figure in the Hebrew Bible. You know, so that could be inspiration. It could be out of body experience, any visions and any voices, which are recounted in the text. Yeah, you know, and the two, you know, primary messages in the Hebrew Bible are, you know, theological and, you know, social or, you know, psychological. And, you know, the theological is, you know, there's one God, you know, the creator and, you know, the sustainer of existence. And, you know, and the golden rule, which is to love your fellow yourself.
Yeah, that's a very, that's one of my very basic philosophies of life is the golden rule. Just treat others as you wish to be treated. I think that's just a very basic code of conduct that everyone should live by and just showing
kindness.
Well,
that's not really the golden rule. The golden rule in Leviticus is to love your fellow as yourself.
Okay.
Which is a lot more, you know, selfless than treat others like you'd want to be treated. You know, when you use that version of the golden rule, which is more of what's in the Christian Bible, you know, that's more, you know, self-oriented, like you're in it for yourself. You don't want people to be mean to you, so you don't be mean to others. That's kind of, you know, selfish in a way. The golden rule is articulated in the Hebrew Bible is to love your fellow as yourself, which is a lot more demanding, a lot more complex a notion.
Okay, well, I like that clarification. That's even probably a lot better than the one that I held. So I appreciate that.
Interesting. Well, certainly have to look at your new book. Very interesting parallel between the prophecies of the Bible and DMT. So. Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
We'll have to wrap up there, but thank you very much for coming on our show. It's been really very exciting for us, especially as we're particularly interested in consciousness.
Yeah, and you're very well known. I'm sure everyone could find you on the internet, www.rickstrassman.com, I believe is your main website.
Right. I've got a, you know, Facebook page too, which is, you know, there's a couple of, you know, fake Rick Strassman Facebook pages, you know, but you'd be able to, you know, recognize the real one. It's, you know, just Rick Strassman on Facebook.
Yeah, you're fairly easy to find, I think, even for, you don't have to be a detective. So,
wonderful.
Right, just type my name into Google or whatever, or, you know, Bondu or Baidu, and I'll come up.
Wonderful.
Great. Thank you so much for this interview. It was a fantastic interview.
Absolutely.
It was a very casual conversational interview with you, but it was just really informative and really interesting. And it was very nice speaking with you on Universal Soul. I really appreciate you coming on here.
Well, great. Great. I'm glad you invited me. And I also enjoyed our chat today very much.
Okay. So we will see you next time on Universal Soul Love.
Goodbye, and listen next time. We'll have some other exciting topic on consciousness.
I'm sure we will.
Or philosophy or spirituality. So this is goodbye from Dr. Lana Love.
And Detective David Love. Bye for now.